I am breathing funny, agreed Clementine. Excellent, said Sam. We need her breathless. Girls, come with me. We've got an important job to do. Holly, I told you, shoes off before you hurt yourself. He grabbed Ruby up off the floor and held her under one arm like a football. She shrieked with delight and ran down the hallway. Holly ran behind, ignoring his directive about the shoes. Keep running until we call for you, shouted Sam from the living room. Clementine, as disobedient as Holly, slowed down to a shuffle. We're ready for you, called Sam. She walked into the living room, half laughing, breathing heavily. She stopped at the doorway. The furniture had been pushed to the corners and a solitary chair stood in the middle of the room behind her music stand. Her cello leaned against the chair, the end pin jammed firmly into the hardwood floor, where it would leave another tiny hole. They'd agreed to call the holes character rather than damage. A queen-sized bedsheet hung from the ceiling, dividing the room. Holly, Ruby and Sam sat behind it. She could hear Ruby giggling. So this was what Sam was so excited about. He'd set the room up to look like an audition. The white bedsheet was meant to represent the black screen where the audition panel sat behind like an invisible firing squad, judging and condemning, faceless and silent, except for the occasional intimidating rustle or cough and the loud, bored, superior voice that could at any moment interrupt her playing with, "That will do, thank you." She was surprised and almost embarrassed by her body's automatic, visceral response to the sight of that lonely chair. Every audition she'd ever done rushed back into her head, a cascade of memories. The time there was only the one warm-up room for everyone, a room so astonishingly hot and airless and noisy, so crowded with extraordinarily talented-seeming musicians that everything had begun to spin like a merry-go-round, and a French cellist had reached out a languid hand to save Clementine's cello as it slipped from her grasp. She was a champion fainter. The time she'd done a first-round audition and played exceptionally well except for a mortifying slip-up in her concerto, not even in a tricky passage, a mistake she'd never made in concert and never made again. She'd been so crushed, she'd cried for 3 hours straight in a Gloria Jean's coffee shop while the lady at the next table passed her tissues and her boyfriend at the time, the oboist with eczema, said over and over, "They forgive you one wrong note." He was right. They forgave her the one wrong note. She'd got the call back that afternoon. But by then she was so spent from all that crying, she played with a bow arm so fatigued it felt as limp as spaghetti, and missed out on the final round. "Sam," she began. It was sweet of him. It was really, really sweet of him, and she adored him for doing it. But it was not helping. "Hello, Mummy," said Ruby, clearly from behind the sheet. "Hello, Ruby," said Clementine. "Shh," said Sam. "No talking." "Why isn't Mummy playing?" said Holly. You didn't need to see her to know she was doing her inverted commas. "I don't know," said Sam. "We won't give this applicant the job if she doesn't play, will we?" Clementine sighed. She'd have to go along with the game. She went and sat on the chair. She tasted banana. Every time she did an audition, she ate a banana in the car on the way in, because bananas supposedly contained natural beta blockers to help with her nerves. Now she couldn't eat bananas at any other time because they made her think of auditions. Maybe this time she could try real beta blockers again. Although the one time she hadn't liked that cotton wool mouth feeling, and her brain had felt kind of blasted clean, as if something had exploded in the center of her head. "Mummy already has a job," said Holly. "She already is a cellist."
"This is her dream job," said Sam.
"Kind of," said Clementine.
"What's that?" said Sam. "Who was that? We didn't hear the applicant talk, did we? She doesn't talk, she just plays."
"That was Mummy," said Ruby. "Hello, Mummy."
"Hello, Ruby,"
Clementine called back as she rosined her bow. Dream job was maybe excessive.
If she were dreaming, she might as well be a world-famous soloist.
But she very, very badly wanted this job. Principal cellist with the Sydney Royal Chamber Orchestra. A permanent position with colleagues and holidays and a schedule. Life as a freelance musician was flexible and fun, but it was so cobbled together, so fragmented and bitsy, with weddings and corporate gigs and teaching lessons and subbing and whatever else she could take. Now that the girls were settled in school and daycare, she wanted to get her career back on track.
She already knew everyone in the string section of the SRCO because she often played for the orchestra casually.
"So you shouldn't have any trouble getting this job then, right? Because you're already doing it," her mother had said last night, cheerfully oblivious to the fierce competitiveness of Clementine's world. Clementine's two older brothers were both working overseas as engineers. Ever since university, their careers had moved forward in a logical, linear fashion. They never wailed, "I just feel like I can't engineer today." Her closest friends in the orchestra, Ainsley and Hugh, a married cellist and double bassist who would be part of the panel sitting behind the screen deciding her fate, were being particularly encouraging. Rationally, Clementine knew she had a shot. It was only her debilitating audition phobia that prevented her making her perfect life a reality. Her terror of the terror. "Preparation is the solution," Sam had told her last night, as if this were groundbreaking advice. "Visualization. You need to visualize yourself winning your audition." It was disloyal of her to think that one didn't win an orchestral audition, and preparing for one was not in the same league as, say, preparing a PowerPoint presentation about sales and marketing plans for a new anti-dandruff shampoo, as Sam's last job had required him to do. Maybe it was the same. She didn't know. She couldn't imagine what people actually did in office jobs, sitting at their computers all day long. Sam was peppy right now. He was leaving for work each day looking very chipper because he'd just got a new job as marketing director for a bigger, more dynamic company that made energy drinks. There were lots of 20-somethings at his new office. Sometimes she could hear their drawling speech inflections creeping into his voice. He was still in the honeymoon stage. Yesterday he'd said something about the forward-thinking corporate culture, and he'd said it non-ironically. He'd only started a week ago. She'd give him a grace period before she started teasing him about it. "Can I go play on the iPad?" said Holly from behind the sheet.
"Shh, your mother is auditioning," said Sam.
"Can I have something to eat then?" said Holly, and then outraged, "Ruby!"
"Ruby, please stop licking your sister," sighed Sam.
Clementine looked up and tried not to think about how the sheet was attached to the ceiling. He wouldn't have stuck thumbtacks in their decorative ceiling, would he?
No, he was the sensible one. She picked up her bow and positioned her cello. The excerpts were on her music stand. There had been no real surprises when she'd gone through them yesterday. The Brahms would be fine. The Beethoven, okay, as long as she phrased the opening convincingly. Don Juan, of course, her nemesis, but she just needed to put the time in. She'd been happy to see the Mahler, fifth movement of Symphony No. 7. Maybe she'd play Sam the Mahler now, keep him happy, and make him think this was helping. As she tuned, she heard Mariana's German-accented voice in her head, giving her audition advice. First impressions count. Even when you are tuning, you must tune quickly, quietly, and calmly. She felt a sudden fresh wave of grief for her old music teacher, even though it had been 10 years since she died. She remembered a time when she'd started to panic because she'd felt she was taking an inordinately long time to tune, and she'd thought she could sense the impatience emanating from the other side of the screen. It was in Perth, and she'd had to carry her perfectly tuned cello across a quadrangle in the most extraordinarily searing heat and into a frosty concert hall. All auditions had a nightmarish quality to them, but that one had been particularly traumatic. The monitor had asked her to take off her shoes before she went on so that her high heels couldn't be heard clicking across the stage and give away her gender. He'd also suggested she try to avoid coughing or clearing her throat, as that too could give away her gender. He was kind of obsessed with it. As she'd walked on stage, one of her stockinged feet had slipped, black stockings, on a 40-degree day. And she'd shrieked in a very gender-specific way. By the time she'd finally tuned the cello, she was a mess. All she could think about as she quivered and sweated and shivered was how much she'd wasted on flights and accommodation for an audition she wouldn't get. My God, she hated auditions. If she got this job, she never, ever wanted to audition again. Ruby, come back. Don't touch. The bedsheet suddenly fell from the ceiling to reveal Sam sitting on the couch with Holly on his lap and Ruby sitting on the floor, looking both guilty and thrilled at what she'd achieved. The sheet pulled around her.
Whisk did it, said Ruby. Whisk did not do it, said Holly. You did it, Ruby.
Okay, okay, said Sam. Relax. He gave Clementine a wry shrug. I got this idea in my head that we'd do a mock audition every Sunday morning after breakfast. I thought it would just be fun and maybe even helpful. But it was probably a bit lame. Sorry.
Holly climbed off Sam's lap and went and pulled the sheet over her head. Ruby climbed under with her and they whispered to each other.
It wasn't lame, said Clementine. She thought of her ex-boyfriend Dean, a double bass player who was now playing with the New York Philharmonic. She remembered practicing for him and how he'd cry, "Next!" and point to the door to indicate her playing wasn't up to scratch, and how she'd burst into tears.
"Fuck this self-doubt of yours is a bore," Dean would yawn.
"Fuck, you were a pretentious twat, Dean, and you weren't even that good, buddy."
"I'll take the girls out for the morning, so you can practice," said Sam.
"Thank you," said Clementine.
"You don't need to thank me," said Sam. "You don't need to feel grateful. Seriously, get that grateful look off your face."
She made her face exaggeratedly blank, and Sam laughed. But she did feel grateful. And that was the problem, because she knew it was the first step in a convoluted journey that ended in resentment. Irrational but heartfelt resentment.
And maybe Sam intuited this, and that's why he was preempting her gratitude. He'd been here before. He knew how the audition was going to affect their lives for the next 10 weeks, as she slowly lost her mind from nerves and the strain of trying to scrounge precious practice time from an already jam-packed life. No matter how much time poor Sam gave her, it would never be quite enough, because what she actually needed was for him and the kids to just temporarily not exist. She needed to slip into another dimension where she was a single, childless person. Just between now and the audition. She needed to go to a mountain chalet, somewhere with good acoustics, and live and breathe nothing but music. Go for walks, meditate, eat well, do all those positive visualization exercises young musicians did these days. She had an awful suspicion that if she were to do this in reality, she might not even miss Sam and the children that much. Or if she did miss them, it would be quite bearable. "I know I'm not much fun when I've got an audition coming up," said Clementine. "What are you talking about? You're adorable when you've got an audition coming up," said Sam. She pretended to punch him in the stomach. "Shut up!" He caught her wrist and pulled her to him in a big bear hug. "We'll work it out," he said. She breathed in his scent. He'd washed himself with the girl's No More Tears baby shampoo again. His chest hair was as soft and fluffy as a baby chick. "We'll get there." She loved the fact that he said "we." He always did this. Even when he was working on some renovation project around the house, a project where she was contributing absolutely nothing except staying out of the way, he'd survey his work, wipe his dusty, sweaty face, and say, "We're getting there." Unselfishness came naturally to him. She kind of had to fake it. "You're a good man, Samuel," said Clementine. It was a line from some TV show they'd watched years ago, and it had become her way of saying, "Thank you, and I love you." "I am a very good man," agreed Sam, releasing her. "A fine man, possibly a great man." He watched the little holly and ruby shapes move about under the sheet. "Have you seen Holly and Ruby?" he said loudly, "because I thought they were right here, but now they seem to have disappeared." "I don't know. Where could they be?" said Clementine.
"We're here,"
trilled Ruby. "Shh." Holly took games like this very seriously. "Hey, what time is this afternoon tea at Erica's place?" said Sam. "Maybe we should cancel." He looked hopeful. "Give you a full day of practice." "We can't cancel," said Clementine. "Erica and Oliver want to, how did she put it? She wants to discuss something." Sam winced. "That sounds ominous." They didn't use the words investment opportunity, did they? Remember when Lauren and David asked us over for dinner and it was all a ploy to try to get us into their bloody environmentally friendly washcloth business or whatever the hell it was? If Erica and Oliver offered us an investment opportunity, we'd take it, said Clementine. We'd definitely take it. Good point, said Sam. He frowned. I bet they want us to join them on a fun run. He put Holly's inverted commas on the words fun run. For a worthy charity, so we'll feel obliged. We'd slow them down too much, said Clementine. Yeah, we would. Or you would. My natural athletic ability would get me through. Sam frowned again and scratched his cheek thoughtfully. Oh, geez. What if they want us to go camping? They'll say it's good for the children. Get them outdoors.
Erica and Oliver were childless by choice, but although they had no interest in having children of their own, they took an active, rather proprietary interest in Holly and Ruby.
It was almost as if it were good for them, as if it were part of a systematic approach they were taking to being well-rounded, self-actualized people. We exercise regularly, we go to the theatre, we read the right novels, not just the Man Booker shortlist, but the Man Booker long list, we see the right exhibitions, and we take a real interest in international politics, social issues, and our friends' cute children. That was unfair. Probably monstrously unfair. Their interest in the children wasn't just for show, and Clementine knew that the reasons they kept their lives in such tight, tidy control had nothing to do with competitiveness.
Maybe they want to set up trust funds for the girls, said Sam.
He considered this, shrugged.
I could live with that. I'm man enough.
They're not that kind of wealthy, laughed Clementine.
You don't think one of them has some terribly rare genetic disease, do you? Said Sam.
Imagine how bad I'll feel then.
He winced.
Oliver looked kind of skinny the last time we saw them.
The marathon running makes them skinny. I'm sure whatever it is, it'll be fine, said Clementine distractedly. Although she did feel a mild sense of unease about today. But that was probably just the audition, already tainting everything, creating a permanent undertone of low-level fear for the next 10 weeks. There was nothing to be frightened about. It was just afternoon tea on a beautiful sunny day.
Chapter 6. A kid in a shiny, wet, black raincoat stood poised on the edge of the ferry, a coil of thick, heavy rope looped over one arm. Sam watched him from his seat by the ferry window. The kid squinted through the torrential rain to see the wharf emerging in the grey mist. His young, unlined face was covered with raindrops. The ferry rolled and pitched. Cold, salty air filled Sam's nostrils. The boy lifted the noose at the end of the rope and held it high, like a cattle wrangler astride a horse. He threw it, snagging the bollard first try. Then he leapt from the ferry to the wharf and pulled tight, as though he were dragging the ferry to him. The kid looked like he was no more than 15, and yet there he was, effortlessly snaring a ferry wharf. He made some sort of signal to the ferry captain and called out, "Circular quay!" to the waiting passengers with their umbrellas and raincoats, and then he wrenched the gangway from the ferry to the wharf with a serious metal bang-clang. The passengers hurried across it onto the ferry, shoulders hunched and huddled against the rain, while the boy stood tall and fearless. See, now that was a good, honest job. Wrangling wharves, herding office workers on and off ferries. He was only a kid, but he looked like a man standing there in the rain. He made Sam feel soft and doughy, sitting docilely in his damp wool trousers, his pinstriped shirt. The kid probably hated the idea of an office job. He'd say, "No way, I'd feel like a trapped rat." A rat pushing a lever to get cheese. Like those old experiments. Yesterday, Sam had sat at his desk like a rat, using his little finger to push the letter P on his keyboard and his thumb to push the space bar over and over, with a space in between each P, until his screen was filled with nothing but P, 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 P. He did that for maybe 20 minutes, maybe even half an hour. He wasn't sure.
That had been his biggest achievement at work yesterday. A screen filled with the letter P. He watched the group of passengers streaming onto the ferry, shaking their umbrellas, their faces grumpy and over it before the day had even begun. The kid probably didn't realize that a white-collar worker could spend a whole day in his office doing nothing, literally sweet fuck all, and still get paid for it. Sam felt himself break out in a cold sweat at the thought of how little he was achieving at work. He had to get something done today. This couldn't go on much longer. He was going to lose his job if he didn't find a way to focus his mind. He was still in his trial period. They could sack him without too much paperwork or stress. At the moment, he was getting away with it because of his team. He had 4 tech-savvy, everything-savvy 20-somethings reporting directly to him. They were all smarter than him. He wasn't managing them. They were managing themselves. But that couldn't go on forever. If Sam had had a blue-collar job, he would have lost it weeks ago. He thought of his dad. Stan the man couldn't go out to a plumbing job and just sit there staring into space, could he? He couldn't mindlessly bang a spanner against a pipe for 20 minutes. If Sam had been a plumber, then he would have been forced to focus and his mind wouldn't be slowly unravelling or whatever the hell was happening to him. Wasn't there a great aunt, somebody or other on his dad's side who'd had a hushed voice, nervous breakdown? Maybe he was having one of those. His nerves were disintegrating, crumbling to dust like porous sandstone. The ferry lurched off, back across the harbour to deliver everyone to their jobs. And as Sam looked at his fellow passengers, it occurred to him that he'd never really belonged. He wasn't one of these corporate people. He'd always liked his work well enough. It was a relatively stimulating way to pay the bills. But there had been those times, as he'd stood at the front of the room with his PowerPoint presentation, for example, when he'd feel, just for a moment, like it was all an act, an elaborate act, like he was just pretending he was the businessman his mother had always dreamed he would be. Not a doctor or a lawyer, a businessman. Joy had no idea what a businessman actually did all day, except that he wore a tie, not overalls, and his fingernails were clean, and that if Sam got good marks at school, which he had, then the glamorous life of business would be his reward. He could have insisted he do a trade like his father and brothers. His mother wasn't domineering, just enthusiastic. But instead, his teenage self had dopily, sleepily gone along with it, without ever really considering what he actually wanted, what would give him satisfaction. And now, here he was, stuck in the wrong life, a middlingly good middle manager, pretending to be passionate about marketing energy drinks. So what? Suck it up. What percentage of people on this ferry felt passionate about their jobs? It wasn't a God-given right that you would love your job. People said to Clementine all the time, "You're so lucky to do what you love." She wasn't grateful enough for that privilege. Sometimes she'd answer, "Yes, but I've always got the fear of wondering if I'm good enough." Her neuroticism about her music had always baffled and bugged him. Just play the damned thing. But now, for the first time, he understood what she meant when she said, "I just feel like I can't play today." He saw again his computer screen filled with the letter P and felt the panic rise. He couldn't afford to lose his job, not with their mortgage. You have a family to protect. Be a man. Pull yourself together. You had it all and you risked it all. For what? For nothing.
He looked out the window as the ferry dipped into a swell of green-grey water laced with white froth, and he heard himself make a sound, a mortifying, high-pitched squeak of distress, like a little girl. He coughed so people would think he'd just been clearing his throat. He found himself remembering the morning of the barbecue. It was like remembering someone else, a friend, or someone he'd seen playing the role of a father in a movie. Surely it had been somebody else, not him, strolling about, strutting about his sunlit house, so sure of himself and his place in the world. What happened that morning? Croissants for breakfast. He'd tried to set up the mock audition for Clementine. It hadn't really worked. What happened next? He had meant to take the girls out so Clementine could practice. They couldn't find Ruby's shoe with the flashing sole. Did they ever find that damned shoe? If someone had asked him that morning how he felt about his life, he would have said he was happy, pleased about the new job. Actually, kind of psyched about the new job. He was all smug about how he'd negotiated flexible hours so he could continue being a hands-on dad, the dad his own father never got to be. And didn't he just lap up all the praise he got for being such an involved father? And laugh sympathetically but enjoyably over the fact that Clementine never got any praise for being an involved mother. He might have had doubts about his role in the corporate world, but he'd never had doubts about his role as a father. Clementine always said that she could tell when Sam was talking to his dad on the phone because his voice went down a notch. He knew he was more likely to tell his dad about some manly DIY project he'd completed around the house than a promotion he'd gotten at work. But he didn't care about the bemused expression his dad got when Clementine said what a great job Sam did doing Holly's hair for ballet. Better than her. Or when he took Ruby off to change or bathe her. Sam was 100% secure in his role as a husband and a father. He thought his own father didn't know what he'd missed. If someone had asked him about his dreams on the morning of the barbecue, he would have said that he didn't want for much, but he wouldn't mind a lower mortgage, a tidier house, another baby, ideally a son, but he'd take another girl, no problem at all, a big motherfucking boat, if it were up for grabs, and more sex. He would have laughed about the sex. Or smiled, at least. A rueful smile. Maybe the smile would have been exactly halfway between rueful and bitter. He found he was smiling bitterly now, and a woman sitting across the aisle from him caught his eye and looked away fast. Sam stopped smiling and watched his hands resting on his knees clench into fists. He made himself unclench them. Look normal. He picked up a newspaper someone had left behind on the seat next to him. It was yesterday's issue. "Enough already," was the headline above an arty-looking picture taken through a spattered window of Sydney's rainy skyline. Sam tried to read the article. Warragamba Dam was expected to spill at any moment. Flash floods across the state. The sentences started jumping around, the way they did now. Maybe he needed his eyes checked. He could no longer read for a sustained period of time before he felt twitchy and anxious. He would look up in sudden terror, as if he'd missed something important, as if he'd fallen asleep. He looked up and caught the eye of the woman again. "For fuck's sake, I'm not trying to look at you. I'm not trying to pick you up. I love my wife." Did he still love his wife?
He saw Tiffany's face in that gold-lit backyard.
Come on, Muscles.
That smile, like a caress. He turned his head towards his ferry window as if he were facing away from Tiffany's physical presence, not just the thought of her, and looked instead at the bays and inlets of Sydney Harbour under a low grey, forbidding sky. Everything had an apocalyptic feel to it. There were things he could say to Clementine, accusations he wanted to hurl, except he knew as soon as they left his mouth, he'd want to snatch them right back, because he deserved far worse. Yet still the accusations hovered, not on the tip of his tongue, but at the back of his throat, lodged there like an undigested lump of food, so he sometimes felt he couldn't swallow properly. Today she was doing another one of those senseless community talks she now did, at some library way out in the distant suburbs. Surely nobody would turn up in this weather. Why did she do it? She was turning down gigs to do this unpaid work. It was incomprehensible to Sam. How could she choose to relive that day when Sam spent his days trying so hard to stop the flashes of shameful memory flickering over and over in his head? Excuse me? Sam jumped. His right arm flew out violently as if to catch something falling. He shouted, "Where?" A woman in a beige raincoat stood in the aisle, staring at him with wide Bambi eyes, both her hands crossed protectively over her chest. "I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to scare you." Sam felt pure, unadulterated rage. He imagined leaping at her, putting his hands around her throat, shaking her like a rag doll. "I just wondered if that was yours. If you are finished with it." She nodded her head at the newspaper. "Sorry," said Sam hoarsely. "I was just deep in thought." He handed her the paper. It shook in his hand. "It's not mine. There you go." "Thank you. So sorry about that," said the woman again. "No, no." She backed away. She thought he was mad. He was mad. As the days went by, he was getting madder and madder. Sam waited for his heart to slow. He turned his head to face the window again. He saw the overseas passenger terminal and remembered that he and Clementine were meant to be going to a restaurant there tonight. A fancy, overpriced restaurant. He didn't want to go. He had nothing to say to her. The thought crossed his mind that they should break up. Not break up. Separate. This is a marriage, buddy. You don't just break up like boyfriend and girlfriend. You separate. What a load of shit. He and Clementine weren't going to separate. They were fine. And yet there was something strangely appealing about that word, separate. It felt like a solution. If he could just separate himself, detach himself, remove himself, then he could get relief. Like an amputation. He stood suddenly. He held onto the backs of seats to balance himself as the ferry rocked and went to stand outside on the deserted deck. The cold, rainy air slapped his face like an angry woman, and the kid in the raincoat looked at him with disinterest, and then his gaze slid slowly away, as if Sam were just another feature of the dull, grey landscape. Sam clung onto the slippery railing that ran along the edge of the ferry. He didn't want to be here. He didn't want to be at home. He didn't want to be anywhere except back in time, in that ludicrous backyard, at that moment in the hazy twilight, the fairy lights twinkling in his peripheral vision, when that Tiffany, a woman who meant nothing to him, nothing at all, was laughing with him, and he wasn't looking at the outrageous Jessica Rabbit curves of her body. He was not looking, but he was aware of them. He was very aware of them.
"Come on, muscles," she'd said.
Right there. That's where he needed to press pause. All he needed was the next 5 minutes after that. Just one more chance. If he could just have one more chance, he'd act like the man he'd always believed himself to be.
Chapter 7. The Day of the Barbecue.
"Let's just forget it," said Clementine. It was nearly 1 o'clock. They were expected at Erica's house for afternoon tea at 3, and Sam and the girls still hadn't managed to actually leave the house to give her the promised practice time. It wasn't going to happen.
"No," said Sam, "I will not be defeated by one small shoe."
One of Ruby's brand new, remarkably expensive, flashing-soled runners had gone missing, and due to a recent growth spurt, those were the only shoes that fit her at the moment.
"What's that poem?" said Clementine. "For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. And then something until the kingdom is lost."
"What?" grunted Sam. He lay flat on his stomach on the floor, looking under the couch for the shoe.
"For want of a shoe, my audition was lost," murmured Clementine as she pulled off cushions from the same couch to reveal crumbs, coins, pencils, hair clips, a sports bra, and no shoe.
"What?" said Sam again. He stretched out his arm. "I think I see it." He pulled out a dust-covered sock.
"That's a sock," said Holly.
Sam sneezed. "Yes, I know it's a sock." He sat back on his haunches, massaging his shoulder.
"We spend half our lives trying to locate possessions. We need better systems, procedures. There must be an app for this, a Where's Our Stuff app."
"Shoo! Where are you?"
"Shoo!" called out Ruby. She walked about lopsidedly, wearing one shoe, stamping it occasionally to make the coloured lights flash.
"Shoes do not have ears, Ruby," said Holly contemptuously.
"Erica says we need a shoe rack by the door." Clementine replaced the cushions on top of all the detritus. "She says we should train the children to put their shoes there as soon as they come in."
"She's right," said Sam. "That woman is always right."
For someone who didn't want children, Erica had a wealth of parenting expertise she felt obliged to share. You couldn't say, "How would you know?" because she always cited her sources. "I read an article in Psychology Today," she would begin.
"She sounds like one of those toxic friends," Clementine's friend Ainsley had once said. "You should cull her."
"She's not toxic," Clementine had said. "Don't you have friends who annoy you?" She thought everyone had friends who felt like obligations. There was a particular expression her mother got when she picked up the phone, a stoic, "here we go" look, which meant her friend Lois was calling.
"Not the way that chick bugs you," said Ainsley.
Clementine could never, would never, cull Erica. She was Holly's godmother. The moment, if there had ever been such a moment, where she could have ended their friendship, was long gone. You couldn't do that to a person. Were there even words for it? Erica would be devastated. Anyway, over recent years, since Erica had met and married the lovely, serious Oliver, their friendship had become much more manageable. Although Clementine had cringed at Ainsley's use of the word, toxic was actually an accurate description of the feelings Clementine had so often felt in Erica's presence. The intense aggravation she had to work so hard to resist and conceal. The disappointment with herself, because Erica wasn't evil or cruel or stupid, she was simply annoying. And Clementine's response to her annoyingness was so completely disproportionate, it embarrassed and confounded her. Erica loved Clementine. She'd do anything for her. So why did she inflame Clementine so? It was like she was allergic to her. She'd learned over the years to limit the time they spent together. Like today, for example, when Erica had suggested lunch, Clementine had automatically said, "Let's make it afternoon tea." Shorter. Less time to lose your mind.
"Please, can I have a cracker, Daddy?" said Holly.
"No," said Sam. "Help look for your sister's shoe." "You girls make sure you say please and thank you to Erica and Oliver at afternoon tea today, won't you?" said Clementine to the girls as she tried behind the curtains for the missing shoe. In a nice, big, loud voice. Holly was outraged.
"I do say please and thank you. I just said please to Daddy."
"I know," said Clementine. "That's what made me think of it. I thought, what good manners." If Holly or Ruby were ever going to forget to say please or thank you, it would be with Erica, who had a habit of pointedly reminding the girls of their manners in a way that Clementine found to be kind of unmannerly.
"Did I hear a thank you?"
Erica would say the moment she handed over a glass of water, cupping her hand around her ear, and Holly would answer, "No, you didn't," which came across as precocious, even though she was just being her literal self. Holly took off her shoes, climbed on the couch, balanced on her socks on the side with her arms held out wide like a skydiver, and then let herself fall, face first, onto the cushions.
"Don't do that, Holly," said Sam. "I've told you before, you could hurt yourself."
"Mummy lets me do it," pouted Holly.
"Well, she shouldn't," said Sam.
He shot Clementine a look.
"You could break your neck. You could hurt yourself very, very badly."
"Put your shoes back on, Holly," said Clementine, "before they get lost too." Sometimes she wondered how Sam thought she managed to keep the children alive when he wasn't there to point out all the perilous hazards. She let Holly do that face-first dive off the side of the couch all the time when he was at work. Mostly, the girls were good at remembering the different rules that applied when Daddy was at home. Not that those different sets of rules were ever actually acknowledged out loud. It was just an unspoken way of keeping the peace. She suspected different rules about vegetables and teeth cleaning applied when Mummy wasn't home. Holly got down off the couch and slumped back.
"I'm bored. Why can't I have a cracker? I'm starving."
"Please don't whine," said Clementine.
"But I'm so hungry," said Holly,
while Ruby wandered off into the hallway hollering,
"Shoo! Where are you, my darling shoo?" "I actually really do need a cracker. Just one cracker," said Holly.
"Quiet,"
shouted Clementine and Sam simultaneously.
"You are both so mean.
Holly turned on her heel to leave the room and kicked her toe on the leg of the couch, which Sam had dragged sideways looking for the shoe. She screamed in frustration. Oh, dear. Clementine automatically bent down to hug her, forgetting that Holly always needed a minute to process her rage at the universe before she accepted comfort. Holly threw back her head and gave Clementine a painful blow on the chin. Ow! Clementine grabbed her chin. Holly! Bloody hell, said Sam. He stomped out of the room. Now Holly wanted a cuddle. She launched herself into Clementine's arms, and Clementine hugged her, even though she wanted to shake her, because her chin really hurt. She murmured sympathetic words of comfort and rocked Holly back and forth while she stared longingly at her cello, sitting quiet and dignified up against her pretend audition chair. No one warned you that having children reduced you right down to some smaller, rudimentary, primitive version of yourself, where your talents and your education and your achievements meant nothing. Clementine remembered when Erica, at the age of 16, had casually mentioned that she never wanted children, and Clementine had felt strangely put out by this. It had taken her a while to work out the reasons for her aggravation. All her life, there had always been so many varied, complex reasons why Erica aggravated her, and she'd eventually realized it was because she wished she'd thought of saying it first. Clementine was meant to be the crazy, creative, bohemian one. Erica was the conservative one, the rule follower, the designated driver. Erica dreamed of getting enough marks to do a Bachelor of Business degree with a double major in accounting and finance. Erica dreamed of home ownership and a share portfolio and a job at one of the big six accounting firms with a fast track to partnership. Clementine's dream was to study at the Conservatorium of Music, to play extraordinary music and experience extraordinary passion. And then, sure, to settle down one day and have babies with a nice man. Because didn't everyone want that? Babies were cute. It had seemed to indicate a failure of the imagination that it had never occurred to Clementine that you could choose not to have children. But that was the thing with Erica. She refused to be typecast. When they were 17, Erica had gone through a goth stage. Erica, of all people. She'd dyed her hair black, worn black nail polish, black lipstick, studded wristbands, and platform boots. What? She'd said defensively, the first time Clementine saw her new look. Erica's rock star style got them into the cool clubs, where she stood at the back scowling, drinking mineral water, and looking like she was thinking dark, gothic thoughts, when she was probably just thinking about her homework, while Clementine got drunk and danced and kissed inappropriate boys and then cried all the way home. Because, you know, life. Now Erica wore clothes you didn't notice or remember. Plain, sensible, comfortable clothes. She had her job at one of the big accounting firms, now one of the big four, not the big six, and her neat, probably mortgage-free, three-bedroom house not far from where they both grew up. And now, of course, Clementine didn't regret her decision to have children. She loved them senseless, of course she did. It was just that sometimes she regretted their timing. It would have made sense to put off kids until they'd paid off more of the house, until her career was better established. Sam wanted a third child, which was ludicrous, impossible. She kept changing the subject every time he brought it up. A third child would be like sliding down a snake in a game of snakes and ladders. He couldn't be serious. She was hoping that eventually he'd see sense. Sam reappeared at the doorway and held out a packet of crackers towards Holly. Holly jumped off Clementine's knee, magically cured, at the same time as Clementine's phone, which was sitting on one of the bookshelves, began to ring. "It's Erica," said Clementine to Sam as she picked it up. "Maybe she's cancelling," said Sam hopefully. "She never cancels," said Clementine. She put the phone to her ear. "Hi, Erica." "It's Erica," said Erica, in that querulous way, as if Clementine had already let her down. "I know," said Clementine. "This newfangled technology is amazing." "Yes, very funny," interrupted Erica. "Look, about today, I was on my way back from the shops and I ran into Vid. You remember Vid? From next door?" "Of course I do. How could I forget Vid from next door?" said Clementine. "The big electrician, like Tony Soprano. We love Vid from next door." Erica sometimes brought out this kind of frivolity in Clementine. "Married to the smoking hot Tiffany." She drew out the word Tiffany. "Sam just loves Tiffany from next door." She looked over at Sam to see if he recognized the name. Sam used his hands to indicate Tiffany's spectacularly memorable figure, and Clementine gave him a thumbs up. They had met Erica's neighbors just once at an awkward drinks party at Erica's place last Christmas. They were maybe a decade older than Clementine and Sam, but they seemed younger. They'd saved the night, as far as Sam and Clementine were concerned. "Well, anyway," said Erica, "I told Vid you were coming over today, and he invited us all over for a barbecue. They've got a daughter, Dakota, who is about 10, and he seemed to think she'd like to play with your girls."
"Sounds great," said Clementine, aware of her spirits lifting, even soaring.
She moved to the window and studied the brilliant blue sky. The day suddenly felt festive. A barbecue. No need to cook dinner tonight. She'd take along that bottle of champagne Ainsley had given her. She'd find time to practice tomorrow. She quite liked this aspect of her personality, the way her mood could change from melancholy to euphoric because of a breeze or a flavour or a beautiful chord progression. It meant she never had to feel too down about feeling down.
"Man, you're a strange girl. It's like you're on drugs," her brother Brian once said to her.
She always remembered that comment. It made her feel proud. "Yeah, I'm so crazy." Although probably that was evidence of her lack of craziness. Truly crazy people were too busy being crazy to think about it. "Vid sort of railroaded me into this barbecue," said Erica defensively. And oddly, because Clementine had never known Erica to be railroaded into anything.
"We don't mind," said Clementine. "We liked them. It'll be fun."
She smiled as she watched Holly waltz around the room with a cracker held ecstatically high, like a trophy. Holly had inherited Clementine's temperament, which was fine, except for when their moods didn't synchronize. Ruby was more like Sam, pragmatic and patient. Yesterday, Clementine had walked into their bedroom to find Ruby sitting on the floor next to Holly, gently patting her shoulder while Holly lay flat on her stomach, prostrate with grief because her drawing of a panda bear didn't look like a panda bear.
"Twy again," Ruby said with a perplexed expression on her face, just like Sam's,
an expression that said, "Why make life so hard for yourself?"
"Okay, well, good. Fun, yes," said Erica.
She sounded disappointed, as if she hadn't actually planned for the day to be fun. It's just that Oliver is kind of cranky with me for accepting Vid's invitation because, as I mentioned, we'd love to discuss this proposal we have, and he thinks we won't have the chance now. I was thinking maybe after the barbecue you could come back to our place for coffee, if there's time.
Of course, said Clementine. Or even beforehand, if you like.
Whichever.
It's all very mysterious, Erica. Can you give me a hint?
Well, no, not really.
Now she sounded almost agitated.
Fine, then, soothed Clementine. We'll talk about this mysterious whatever it is after the barbecue.
Or before, said Erica. You just said,
or before, agreed Clementine, just as Ruby toddled into the room carrying a tiny plastic pink gumboot in each hand and looking pleased with herself.
Oh, clever girl, Ruby. You can wear your gumboots.
That's a great idea.
I beg your pardon? Said Erica, who could never bear it when Clementine spoke to her kids when she was on the phone to her. She seemed to think it was a breach of etiquette.
Nothing, sure. Let's talk before the barbecue.
See you then, said Erica briskly, and she hung up in that infuriatingly abrupt way of hers, as if Clementine were her lowly intern.
It didn't matter. A barbecue with Erica's charming neighbours on this sunny winter's day would be fun. What could be nicer?
Chapter 8. The rain eased slightly, although, of course, it didn't stop. It would freaking well never stop. So Tiffany took the opportunity to grab an umbrella and drag their recycling bin, rattling indiscreetly with wine and beer bottles from the previous night, down her driveway. She was thinking about Dakota and the smile she'd given Tiffany when she dropped her off at school this morning. A cool, polite smile, as if Tiffany were someone else's mother. There was something going on with Dakota. It was subtle, this thing. It might be nothing, or it might be something. It wasn't that she was misbehaving, not at all. But there was something spookily distant about her. It was like she was encased in an invisible glass bubble. For example, this morning at breakfast, Dakota had sat straight-backed at the table, chewing daintily on her toast, her eyes flat and unreadable. Yes, please. No, thank you. Why was she being so polite? It was creepy. It was like they had a well-mannered foreign exchange student boarding with them. Eating disorder? But she was still eating, although not with much enthusiasm. Tiffany couldn't get to the bottom of it, no matter how hard she tried or what questions she asked. I'm fine, Dakota kept saying in her mechanical new way.
She's fine. Leave the kid alone, Vid said. It made Tiffany want to scream. Dakota was not fine. She was 10 years old. A 10-year-old shouldn't smile politely at her mother. Tiffany was determined to smash right through this freaking glass bubble thing Dakota had going on, even if she was imagining it. She was nearly out on the street when she saw Oliver bringing out his recycling bin too, although it wasn't rattling as much as hers.
Morning, Oliver, she called out. How are you? Isn't this rain terrible?
Shit. Every time she saw her neighbours now, ever since the barbecue, her stomach muscles tensed, as if she was doing a Pilates crunch. She'd always liked Oliver. He was so straightforward and polite. A bit of a dork, with his black hair and spectacles, like a grown-up Harry Potter. He had a very small head. She couldn't help but notice. There was nothing to be done about his pea head, but Tiffany should tell Erica to buy Oliver some of those vintage black-rimmed glasses. transform her husband into a cute hipster in just one move. Vid had a massive head. You couldn't get a baseball cap to fit him. Not that he'd ever wear a baseball cap. "How are you, Tiffany?" called back Oliver. He neatly pulled his bin to a noiseless stop while Tiffany grunted as she hauled hers over the curb. "Need a hand?" "No, no, I've got it. Aren't you nice to offer? Don't hear Vid offering." "Ugh, that's my workout done for the day." It wasn't. She was going to the gym later. "What are you doing home at this hour? Taking a sickie?" She walked over to within chatting distance and noted Oliver's terrified glance at her cleavage. He fixed his eyes desperately on her forehead as if she were a test. "Yeah, buddy, I'm a test, but you pass every time." "I am, actually, getting over a bit of a flu thing." Oliver put his fist over his mouth and coughed. "How's Erica?" said Tiffany. "I haven't seen her much lately." "She's fine," said Oliver shortly, as if that were personal. "Jeez Louise. Ever since the barbecue, every conversation with Erica and Oliver felt as strained and difficult as if she were talking to an ex-boyfriend straight after a breakup. A breakup that was her fault. A breakup where she'd cheated. "And, so we haven't seen you much since..." She broke off. "How are Clementine and Sam?" Oliver coughed. "Oh, they're okay," he said. He frowned off into the distance over Tiffany's shoulder. "And how is, you know, it seems like a while since Harry has had his bin out," interrupted Oliver. Tiffany turned and looked at the empty spot on the road in front of Harry's house. Or Mr. Spitty's house, as Dakota called him, because of his habit of spitting with disgust at all the things that disgusted him, like Dakota. Sometimes he looked at Tiffany's beautiful daughter and spat as if her very existence offended him. "He doesn't put it out every week," said Tiffany. "I don't think he creates a lot of rubbish." "Yeah, I know," said Oliver, "but it feels like it's been weeks since I've seen him. I wonder if I should go bang on his door." Tiffany turned back to look at Oliver. "He'll probably just yell abuse at you." "He probably will," agreed Oliver ruefully. "He really was a nice guy. It's just that it feels like it's been a long time between abusive tirades." Tiffany looked at Harry's dilapidated two-story red brick Federation house. It was always kind of depressing to look at. The paint peeling off the window frames, the faded red roof tiles in need of repair. Gardeners came once a month to mow the lawns and trim the hedges, so it wasn't like it was derelict. But ever since they'd moved here, and Harry had come over to welcome them to the neighbourhood with a demand that they do something about their oak tree, it had been a sad, lonely-looking old house. "When did I see him last?" said Tiffany. She searched her mind for unpleasant incidents. A few times Harry had stood in his front yard and yelled at Dakota and made her cry, and that had made Tiffany lose her temper and yell back at Harry in a way that made her feel ashamed afterwards, because he was an old man and probably had dementia, so she should have shown more respect and self-control. What was the last thing one of them had done to upset Harry? Then she remembered. "You're right," she said slowly to Oliver, her eyes on the house. "It has been a while since I saw him." In fact, she knew exactly when she'd seen Harry last. It was the morning of the barbecue.
That goddamned nightmare of a barbecue she'd never wanted to host in the first place.
Chapter 9. The Day of the Barbecue. It was quiet. It was always especially quiet the moment directly after Vid left the room. It was like the moment after a band stopped playing, when the silence roared in your ears. Tiffany could hear the tick of the clock. She never heard the clock ticking when Vid was in the room. Tiffany sat at the kitchen table catching up on email on her laptop and eating Vegemite on toast. Vid had gone down the driveway to collect the paper, muttering about how he had to hunt for it each day in the garden and he was going to cancel the delivery. "Read it electronically, like the rest of the world," Tiffany always told him. But although Vid was generally enthusiastic about trying new things, he was also extremely loyal, and his loyalty to certain habits and personal rituals, products, and people was unshakable. "Isn't it quiet when Daddy leaves the room?" Tiffany said to Dakota, who lay on her side on the long bay window seat, curled up like a cat in a rectangle of quivering morning sunlight. Barney, their miniature schnauzer, lay next to Dakota, his nose and paws resting on Dakota's arm, his eyes shut so all you could see were his big bushy eyebrows. Barney was a dog who napped like a cat. Dakota was reading, of course. She was always reading, disappearing into different worlds where Tiffany couldn't follow. Well, she could follow if she could be bothered to pick up a book, but reading made Tiffany restless. Her legs started to twitch impatiently after one page. TV made her restless too, but at least she could fold laundry or pay bills while she watched. At Dakota's age, Tiffany never would have picked up a book for pleasure. She was into makeup and clothes. The other day, Tiffany had offered to paint Dakota's nails, and Dakota had responded with a kind, vague, maybe later, Mum. It was her karma for all the times her own sweet domestic mother had suggested that Tiffany might like to help her bake something, and Tiffany had apparently said, according to family folklore, "Will you pay me?" "You were always so keen to be compensated," her mother said. "Well, time is money." "It's quiet, isn't it?" said Tiffany when Dakota didn't answer. "What?" said Dakota. "You mean, pardon?"